was there in the early 2000 during that period of time. And it gave me a good foundation to build on my Dharma understanding. And more importantly, that became a platform for me to launch off in my Dharma practice, like serious Dharma practice. Before that, you know, before 2000, the year 2000 or 1999, that was when I first came around uni. But before that, I was practicing Buddhism here and there. By really having a community to come together to then share, discuss, and deepen the practice under the guidance of many teachers across different sect, different traditions has been really, really helpful. So it is wonderful always to be back here. As I was saying the other day, I've been away from teaching for about 1.5 years now because of new duties of being a father. So now that my son is 16 months old, I can be released to do other duties in the community. So it's wonderful to be here. I think that before we go any further, it might be useful for us just to have a few minutes of just a short exercise, not really meditation, but just some mental exercises just to arrive, to help us just to kind of arrive into this space. And I'll ask you to probably have just sit in a comfortable position. You can have your eyes open, you can have your eyes closed. And just mainly focusing on just relaxing the body. Yeah, if it's helpful, I find that it can be helpful to close your eyes. However, it's just whatever suits you, because it just reduces one input so that we can just bring our awareness to the body. So as we work our way around, just noticing the head, the face, the neck area, just releasing any tension around this part of the body. Moving down to the shoulders, just relaxing. And the arms, the hands. Just allowing the weight to just drop. Just relaxing into this posture. Letting go of any tension on the chest, on the stomach area. Letting go of tension on the back, upper back, lower back. And also the lower parts of the body, the thighs, the legs, softening, easing into this space. Noticing our feet, whether it's touching the floor, touching the chair, just noticing that. And just paying attention to the entire body. Taking a few deep breaths. Each outgoing breath, just letting your body and mind settle. You're not trying to make it a certain way, you're just allowing yourself to just let go a little. Soften into this space, into this moment for a few moments. There's no need to force it, it just is. If it's tight, it's tight, you just try to soften it just a little bit. If it's quite at ease, then just see whether it can just drop just a little bit further into this space. Just noticing the entire body, just letting go of tension, letting go of any tightness, and just breathe. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes, and just bring your awareness back again into the space as we complete this short practice. Very often, physically, we may be in a certain place, but mentally, we are not there, right? We're sitting here, our body is physically here, but our mind could be, who knows, anywhere, halfway around the world, in all different ideas, concepts. And that's just the nature of the mind. It's not that there's something wrong. It's not that you've got a weird mind or anything like that. It's just is how human nature is and how our minds are. Our minds are a very interesting and very useful, very helpful aspect of our experience. But it's also the mind itself that can cause us a lot of pain. Yeah. It is one of the capacity of being human. We think, theoretically, that probably humans have a large capacity based on the size of the brain, different brain regions, that we have a huge capacity called the frontal cortex, which allows us to think and ideas in abstract, and also be able to think about the past and venture into the future, make plans. And this capacity we have largely defines us as humans. At least that's from a theoretical perspective. We know that a lot of mammals are able to do that, but we think that probably based on just human brain itself, our ability to do that is probably much higher than any other mammals, which is great. We're able to learn from the past, be able to think back at the good memories, learn from past mistakes. We can plan ahead. Yeah, we can make plans in terms of whether we need to save for the coming days, or make plans, organize things, communicate with each other, create language, complex language, design things. Because our ability to work with ideas and concepts. At the same time, it is also this very ability that sometimes gets us stuck. Yeah. It is also our mind that can also cast a lot of pain, cast shadows, create stuckness in our lives. It is our mind that can lock us into things that we can't let go of in the past, the pains that's occurred to us, or the fears about the future, whether or not that is true, whether or not that is going to eventuate. It is a lot that the mind itself is what projects up these things. In some ways, it's quite neutral, right? What is the strength of the mind is also the shadow of it. It's just a neutral ability for us to do that. It comes with it, its perks, its positives, but also comes with it its pain and distress sometimes. If you ever experience stress, and I think all of us at some point in our lives, larger to lesser extent, experience some level of stress or even distress, it is often comes down to where the mind is and the state of the mind. If you really want to define what stress is, I'm a clinical psychologist by profession. In fact, I work at University of New South Wales. My job is to train clinical psychologists. So a large part of my work is understanding how the mind works and also how people can get stuck, including myself and the people I work with, including the clients that I work with, how the mind can get stuck or unstuck in situations. A lot of my work is working with people with depression, with anxiety, and a large part of it is what is actually occurring in our minds. How are we perceiving things? How are we approaching things? Right? Like I say, the same, very same thing, that's a wonderful tool that we have that's given us so much ability to be able to progress as probably as a community, as a race, is also what sometimes gets us down. When we look at the stress response itself, in some ways it's physiological. You can measure stress response, how much stress hormone there is in the body. But really it comes down to when you experience it, you probably experience it as like a mental pain. Yeah. Now, if this talk was me as a psychologist, I might take you down the science of it, what meditation can do, can be helpful, different types of things that can be helpful working with stress, like, you know, having good diet, making sure you're having enough rest, making sure they're having enough activities, making sure you have enough fresh air, you're moving around enough, not too much, not too little, having healthy lifestyle, being able to take perspective in your mind, be able to think clearly, not be bogged down by things that are not helpful or things that are untrue. Very often working in psychology is working with people to work out what is actually true and what is actually not true that the mind actually throws up our way. So that will be a very different talk. But today the talk is about overcoming stress from a Buddhist perspective. I've been a serious practitioner of Buddhism for probably about over 20 years now, and a meditator for about 19 years, almost 20 years now, like seriously learning about meditation. And really the heart of what the Buddha's message is in Buddhism is about working with pain and suffering in the mental level. That's the heart of Buddhism. The Buddha said very clearly, I've taught one thing. Yeah, I have taught one thing and one thing only. That is dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. Dukkha is an old in old Pali term that translates messily, probably into a term that's called suffering, distress, or pain, mental anguish, dissatisfaction, or you can call it also stress. Yeah, the tension of the mind, the tension of and the mental level. So the Buddha said, I've taught one thing and one thing only, which is, if you take the translation, stress and the cessation of stress. Cessation means the going away, the release of stress. So the Buddha said, I only teach one thing, which is how do you work with your mind? You know, with distress and the disappearance of distress. And in this teaching, that the heart of what Buddhism is about is the Four Noble Truths that hopefully we're all fairly familiar with. And these are truths about the fundamental summary of what Buddha's practice is about. And the first noble truth, the first truth that he said is that what in life is characterized by pain and suffering, right? It's not that that's the only thing, but in life there is suffering, there is pain. Yeah? And sometimes people who don't understand where the Buddha is coming from think that, oh, what is such a pessimistic view of life? Everything is about suffering, suffering. First noble truth is the truth about suffering. Second noble truth is the truth about how suffering arises. The third noble truth is about the cessation of suffering. The fourth noble truth is the path to the cessation of suffering. It's a lot of suffering. But if you really look at it closely, it's hardly a pessimistic perspective. It's not optimistic, that's for sure. But it's probably a very practical approach to life. This reminds me of a story that one of my favorite meditation teachers, S.N. Goenka, a Vipassana teacher, very well known around the world, is no longer with us. He probably died about 5 or 8 years ago. He says that there's a story of a mother with three children, right? The first child, he says, all right, you know, this is 50 cents. Go out, go get, use the bicycle, go to the village, go to the town area and buy me a bottle of oil. So old story, 50 cents can buy you a fair bit of oil, right? So the first child cycle. And then when there, goes there, pay the money, buy the bottle of oil, happily cycles back. Halfway, the bicycle toppled, accident happened. And then half of the oil flowed out. So then the child quickly grabbed it, the bottle, and then there was half of the oil left. So crying, he was so upset, he was crying all the way back to home, right? And then gave the half bottle of the oil to the mother. So that was the first child, the first day. Second day, mother needed more oil, gave 50 cents to the second child, right? So then again, took the bicycle, cycle, paid the money, bought a bottle of oil, and then cycle back. And as the story will have it, same place, also same incident, fell off the bicycle, right? This is just a story, so go along with it. So the bottle of oil half came out. And then the child quickly grabbed the bottle and then says, oh, luckily I saved half a bottle. He was so happy, right? So then he took the half of the bottle, quickly cycled back and gave in a very big smile and told the mother what happened. I fell down, I managed to save half the bottle of oil. So that's the second day, second child. Third day, third child. Same case, mother needed a bottle of oil, 50 cents, cycle, to the town, to the village, bought a bottle, came back on the way, and as the story would have it, same place, same thing happened, third time in a row, third child fell off the bicycle, half of the oil flowed out. What happened? The child quickly picked up the bottle, half of the bottle of oil was still there, and he's like, okay, all right. Cycle home and then told the mother what happened and then said, Mom, don't worry. By the end of the day, right, I'm going to go out, I'm going to find some work that's going to pay me 25 cents. And I'm going to actually top up that half bottle of oil. Some would say that the first child is a little bit pessimistic, only sees the half bottle of oil gone. Some will say that the second child is optimistic, seeing the half of the bottle of oil that's left. How about the third child? The third child is a realist, right? He or she sees what is the situation, right? It's real, half a bottle left. Also takes action to say that how can I actually top this bottle of oil? And really at the heart of it, this is what the Buddha's practice, the Buddha's teaching is about. The first noble truth tells us that, you know, you're going to experience pain and suffering because of the sheer fact that you're born into this world, you have the faculties that you have, right, the mind and the body. And because of this, you have the capacity to experience pain and distress, suffering and stress, right? So that's the first noble truth. You need to first acknowledge what is actually before you, right? He didn't say that there is no joy. In fact, he says that there is a capacity for you to build joy, right? But you need to work on the mind. So that's why the first noble truth is, in fact, a quite realistic view about life. And sometimes that's exactly what we don't do, right? When we feel stress, when we feel pain, the first thing that we want to do is what? Run. Push it away. Say that it doesn't exist. No, I'm not stressed. I'm a good Buddhist. Good Buddhists don't become stressed. I'm a meditator. Ah, right? You struggle with it. Yeah. And sometimes it's in a struggle that creates even more pain. Yeah. Life shoots the first arrow. It's a very old analogy in Buddhism. Life shoots the first arrow. But how we respond to the first arrow is like we see one arrow that's got shot at us, and then we go and get ourselves another bow and arrow and shoot ourselves again. So life shoots the first arrow, but because of how we deal and respond to the first arrow, it's like us shooting ourselves over and over again. And what we end up is like a pin cushion with arrows all over us. Life shoots the first arrow. There's no doubt about that. The Buddha says, you know, aging, sickness, death, you know, being with those you do not want, you do not like, being in situations you do not like, or being apart from the people or the situations that you like, all those generate stress, pain, and suffering. But we sometimes add a bit more to it. We see the suffering, we struggle, we push, we shove, or we deny it, we try to actually struggle and push. And in the pushing, we generate even more and more stress and tension. And I feel that part of the invitation of the first noble truth is for us to first acknowledge where we are. Yes, there is pain, there is suffering, there is stress, there is distress. And firstly, we need to actually make peace and acknowledge what is there, which is not easy to do. It's easier said than done. When you're in pain, when you're suffering, there's mental anguish, the hardest thing to do is in fact acknowledging that, yes, this is the reality of now, to open our hearts and minds towards this state. Things that are pleasant, wonderful states, I like. But if I'm stressed, I don't like. This is how we go around in our lives. Right? This is what the Buddha says. We go around our lives pulling and pushing. Things that we like, we pull. Right? We want more. Things that we don't like, we push. And the whole life is essentially what we do. Yeah, and this is what he says in the second noble truth, but you know, what's the root cause of pain and suffering or stress is our craving, is our thirst of pulling and pushing away this tendency. If the Buddha only say yes, first noble truth and second noble truth, then you know, good luck you all. Yep, see you all. Then maybe we can say that Buddhism is a little bit pessimistic, it tells us the problem but doesn't give us a solution. But the third noble truth says there is a way out. If there's suffering and pain, there's also a state whereby there is no suffering and no pain. And there's a possibility of attaining that. And then the fourth noble truth says, these are the three trainings or the eight trainings, which is the Eightfold Path that you can do to actually work on training yourself to come out of suffering. And it's all about mental training. It doesn't matter if we are well, unwell, it's all in from the mental perspective of training. Those of you who are familiar with the Eightfold Path, we know that it is also categorized sometimes as the three studies or the three training, the training of morality, training of samadhi, which is the mastery of the mind, right? And then the training of wisdom, of panya. The Buddha gave us clear directions as to how we can train our mind. But first of all, we need to meet the pain and suffering and the distress that we have by acknowledging it, by opening to it. And if you understand what the second noble truth is about, it's just kind of holding tight, the tension that's holding there. We learn to ease ourselves into it. We learn to let go and relax into it. And when we do that more and more, then there's a possibility of us learning and training the mind to be able to be more open and less be less affected by the pains, the difficulties that comes out in our day-to-day life. This is a possibility, right? He has shown us that it's possible. And each step that you take in your path, you can see for yourself. For me, it was years back that I started Buddhist practice, way before I became a psychologist, even before I trained as a psychologist. And I found that it really helped. Each step of the way, when the challenges became bigger, it had bigger tools and bigger resources for me to use. Let's go back to the Eightfold Path, the three trainings, the most basic morality. Having a good moral, ethical life provides a good foundation for us. It just cuts out a lot of trouble that we're gonna possibly have. A lot of issues that we have is because we do not act skillfully, we do not say the right things, or we actually go against things like the moral precepts. You know, the moral precept is not that, you know, some higher being is there taking record of what you're doing and then because of that dishing out punishment. It's not. Right? The five precepts, which is, you know, the ethical living, the guidelines for ethical living, that helps us to stay out of trouble, essentially, right? By not harming others, by living a life that's beneficial to others and beneficial to ourselves. And also when we got a good foundation, rightful living, rightful speech, rightful actions, then we can also reflect that, yes, I am living a good, righteous life. And that in itself gives us some mental resource to say that at least I, hand on heart, I have lived the best I can in the ethical manner. So that's the training to do with morality. The training to do with samadhi, which is the mastery of the mind, this is when it gets interesting. Whatever we do day in, day out, we're creating habits. What you do, what you not do, day in, day out, every moment you are creating habits. And the usual habits that we have is, like I was saying earlier, we pine after things that are positive and we're pushing away things that are not good. So that's how we react. We respond to life, pulling, pushing, generate so much stress, so much distress for ourselves. The practice of samadhi really is knowing how to work with the mind and strengthen the mind in a way that's helpful. The three elements in there, right? Mindfulness, right effort, right concentration, right? Knowing how to pay attention, having awareness of what's actually coming up, that's right mindfulness. Applying effort in doing the things that are helpful, developing good habits of the mind. Right concentration, be able to work the mind so that it's able to stay, right? Be able to still the mind, quiet down the mind, let go of things, being able to ease into this. These are really essentially changing the habit patterns of the mind. It is about mental training. And Buddhism is not something that comes to you like, you know, if you don't invest in it, and then when you need it, when you're stressed and you suddenly go like, where's Buddhism? Like, how can it help me? It's not like that. It's essentially a path that you need to invest and train gradually. And each step that you take, that much return that you have. Right? I used to not understand Buddhism growing up in the kind of traditional Buddhist environment. When you have difficulties, you go in front of the Buddha statue and you ask for, you know, please, can you help me with this exam or whatever, or sickness or whatever it is. When you come to know Dharma, when you come to know the Buddha's teaching, you know that a lot of it is, it needs to come down to what you have been doing day in, day out in your life. If you're a person who naturally day in, day out practices anger, practices hatred, practices craving, practices clinging, practices so many different things, jealousy or whatever, there's unhelpful states of mind. Of course, when things arise in life, that's naturally where your mind is going to go to. But if you're able to train the mind to be generous, to be open, to be joyful, right, to have kindness, to have compassion, to have a sense of stability, steadiness, then when times come, then that naturally comes to the foreground. You can't run away. You can't rely on someone else. You can't outsource this. You can't subcontract to someone else. Hey, can you do some practice and send it my way? It doesn't work. That's why sometimes Buddhism is difficult, right? It's not an easy path. It's something that you have to actually do and practice. That much that you practice, that much you gain over time. Because the mind is the forerunner of all things, right? It is your own mind that you actually experience from moment to moment. And each, whatever you put into it, that's, you're just training it. So if you're like training it to always get upset, you train it, of course, it's just naturally going to be very good. It's a master of getting upset, right? If you're someone that just pushes or avoid, then of course the mind's tendency becomes anything that comes up that you don't like, you don't know what to do, just avoid. It becomes easier and easier. They become a pattern that you form. So really the training of samadhi is really about what type of habits are you creating in your mind. And the Buddha was actually very kind to give us suggestions as to what are the useful states of the mind for us to develop. The four immeasurables, for example, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. If you can develop these four states, you know, when you actually know how to practice, you can enter these states at will. You can just, regardless of what happened, just enter into a state that is joyful, that is wide, that's open, right? If you practice, then you can just enter into a state where the mind is just naturally light and open. But without practice, like, and the times of need, how can we actually find that? Right? It requires some level in pre-investment, then the returns come, because it is a path of self-responsibility. The third part is the practice. So the three trainings. The first training is morality. Second training is about mastery of the mind. And third part is the training of wisdom. Wisdom is being able to see things clearly, to be able to recognize what is helpful to actually pursue, what is not helpful to pursue. Right? To be able to see the reality of life that, you know, things change. Right? That we don't control things. As much as we try to control things, right, we can for a short moment, but ultimately we can't. There's a lot of things that's beyond our control because it's not about us. There's no self in there. Even our body, we can't say that stop getting sick, stop getting, you know, crinkly or old, stop having this pain. There's no control over it, right? It's like we live with this, but we don't own it, right? So reality, seeing things clearly. A lot of stress and pain comes out to not seeing reality clearly. And therefore, we have unhelpful expectations of how things should be. Whenever you're stressed or in pain, you're typically wanting something else and not wanting whatever is here. It's always that. It comes down to that. Whatever pain and suffering that's there, there's something that you're trying to push away that is actually unpleasant. And again, we're not blaming anyone here. This is just how our mind is. It's just how humans are, right? It's the beauty of what human beings are able to do, but it's also where they can get stuck in the process. Yeah. By being able to see time and time again the reality of change, of impermanence, for example, that helps us to start to then recognize, well, actually everything changes. But if we don't train our minds to see, having right view about things, having right thoughts about things, then we are seeing things in a skewed manner. And that's why when the time comes, we expect it to be A, but B appears, we're like, oh, actually, why B appear? I don't like B, I want A, right? Highly unhelpful expectation that it should be B, or should be A, but when it's B, that's where pain and suffering arises too. Yeah. So really, Buddhist training is all about that, about each moment, what we're inclining the mind to do, what we are seeing. Deeply seeing the reality of life helps a lot in reducing pain and suffering. The Buddha says, no matter how you are, you will still have, life is always going to shoot the first arrow. Even the Buddha at the ripe old age of 80, he was enlightened at the age of about 35. And he continued teaching for the rest 45 years. In the later part of his years, when he was a bit older, if you look at the scriptures, it says that there were times he could not give a Dharma talk because he had a very bad backache. Yeah, so he had to sometimes tell his attendant, Ananda, I have a backache, so please go and teach on my behalf, and he would rest. Yeah. And I think that's a very beautiful, like, modeling or showing us what reality is. Because even him, the wonderful Buddha, at the older age, he had back pain too, that at times that he wanted to teach, but he couldn't. He had to rest. But then he asked Ananda to go and teach, his attendant to go and teach instead. Right, and he rested. But his mind was not affected by it. That's the difference. And that's what's actually possible. That the life shooting the first arrow at us, this is reality of life. It just shoots arrow at us. But you don't add the second, third, fourth, fifth arrow afterwards that we shoot on ourselves. And if we can actually reduce that much, that's going to be helpful for us. I've said probably enough for the time being. It's probably useful for me to open up for questions. So if you have questions, feel free to ask. Feel free to type your messages as well. And if there's anything particular direction you want me to go to, I can. Trust me, I can talk nonstop for the next 5 hours. I'll still have more content. But let's hear what you want to hear about. What are the things that you've come to this talk wondering? And let's expand on that. So please ask your question, and I'll try my best to actually give you a response from what I know and what deep down from my heart as well. So please ask if you've got any questions or any comments. Feel free to type, feel free to unmute yourself, and we can have a chat. So there's a question from Mabel Tay. What are the simple ways in daily life to train samadhi and patience to reduce stress? Very good question. Simple ways in daily life to train samadhi and patience to reduce stress. Okay. I'll give you a very simple starting point. See whether this helps. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to count how many breaths that you take. In the period of time that I say, I'll tell you when to start counting. So I say start, you count how many breaths you're taking in now. One, two, three, or however many. And then I'll tell you stop, and I ask you all to just type out how many breaths that you counted. Okay? Don't try to change it, just whatever it is. Can we do that together? So I'll tell you when. Let me get my clock. All right, so hang on. Okay, ready? Start. Just counting how many breaths that you're taking in this period of time. All right, that's the time. How many breaths did you take during that period from my time I said start until I said end? Just type it out. Just everyone just put in your numbers. 10, 20, 25, however many, 3,000, 25, 20, 21, 17, 16, 20. Feels like looking like an index dropping. Thank you for your answers. 25, 20, 21, 17, 16, 20. Okay. All right, 10. Okay, so some of you a bit lower. All right, so that is your baseline. Yeah, so in an adult, resting potential typically is anywhere between 16 to 25. So you essentially bang on, essentially, yeah, you're right in the region. What I want to get you to do is for this next period of time, I want you to just elongate it a little bit, right? Just extend the breath a little bit longer, just slowing it down a little bit. Yeah, I'm gonna tell you start, and I'm gonna tell you to stop again. I'm gonna ask you how many times you breathe. This time you count, but just slightly slowing it down a little bit. Don't force it too much, just inviting it to be a little bit slower. Okay, ready? stop. How many breath was there? Same period of time, which is 1 minute. How did it all go? Just feel free if you want to just type it out, however many. All right. You can see that overall there's a slight reduction overall. Yeah. What I'll get you to do is, let's go for a little bit longer this time. Again, just allowing the breath just to elongate just a little bit more. Yeah, we'll go for 2 minutes this time and let's just see how we go. Okay. Ready? Go. And don't worry about counting this time. What I want you to do is just allow your breath just to be just a little bit longer. Don't force it, it's fine. Just inviting it to be just a little bit slower. Don't worry about counting it, just noticing it. Relax. And see whether you can have a little smile on your face. Just a little half smile. Or a large smile if you want to. The bigger the better, but even just a half smile. Just breathe. Elongate it just a little bit more. Slowing it down. Don't have to force it. Just inviting you to slow down just a little bit, having a smile. All right, that's 2 minutes. In one or two words, how was that last 2 minutes for you? Just feel free to type it up. Feel free to share, feel free not share, doesn't matter. How was it for you? Just slowing it down, just dropping it down a little bit. How was it for you? Some people was peaceful, relaxing. Peaceful. Okay. Sleepy, yep. Yeah. Can be quite tiring. Peaceful. Okay. Not rushing. Yep. So it slows down, drops down a little bit more. All right, good. This is just a very quick method. It's like a pre-preparation even, like not even really entering into like real training yet, but this is just simply just able to drop down. The practice of meditation and Dhamma, it's about not attaining, not getting somewhere, but to releasing that which is not helpful. It is about letting go. Yeah. So a lot of the training about Samadhi and training about the habits of the mind is knowing how to soften, release, and relax into it, right? And of course, sometimes when you do that, it can be relaxing, can be peaceful, but sometimes in the process as you do that, you can also churn up certain things. Sometimes it's not unusual that you can feel sometimes quite uneasy too, like quite agitated too, that can come up. But the thing is that you just continue to keep dropping. So what you're training the mind to do is to just be able to let go and be at ease. And of course, that was just 2-3 minutes worth of playing around with it. If you are doing this often, you become very skilled to be able to drop and release and relax. Yeah. And your capacity to deal with and doing that in tougher and tougher situations become more and more second nature. That's why I say you need to invest in this. Yeah. Imagine if you keep training training your mind to be able to do that. Yeah, day in, day out, like that. Right, and really the principle of it is not how many breath and everything, but it's just being able to just slow it down, just drop, just relax, just learn to do that. Each time the mind will tense up, you soften it. Tense up, you just soften it a little bit. You keep doing that over and over again, you're training the mind to do what? That it's actually okay, that you can remain open. When we are stressed, the mind is like this. The mind is not open, it's not pliable, it's not light. It's like, oh, what's going on? Yeah, it's very tense. If you're able to learn to just soften, and becomes part of what we do, naturally that becomes a new habit that actually arises. Yeah. So for those of you in meditation practice, yeah, even the first few moments, just allow yourself, just taking a few moments to just slow things down, just to let things settle, and then you do your practice, whether it's metta practice, whether it's vipassana practice, or whatever, chanting, whatever you do, you're training the mind to just settle in, let go, right, settle down. So that's one quick method. So maybe Mabel is saying something that you can try, that's good. The other thing is also what you can do to play around with is where you're inclining the mind to. When the mind is stressed, anxious, or tense, it closes up. Yeah. So there are some ways, even in Buddhist practice, to help you open up just that tiny little bit. Yeah. You can do it in many different ways, but one thing that I find that can be really helpful is this practice. Now, I just invite you to do this. Just do it as much as you want to, if you can. So just take a breath in, take a deep breath out, and just I wanted for you to bring to mind what are five things that you're grateful for. Doesn't matter what it is, just five things that you're grateful for right now. What are five things that I'm grateful for? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Doesn't matter if you can't go up to 5, but just thinking of the things that you are grateful for. There's no right or wrong answer. It's whatever you are grateful for right now. And see if you can bring a little bit of a smile on your face as you're thinking about these things that you're grateful for. Okay. If you're happy to, just share how that experience was for you. What slight things, very minor things that you notice in yourself and in your mind? To just type out 1-2 words, that's fine. It's completely fine if you don't want to as well. No pressure. Just bringing your mind, inclining your mind just towards gratitude a little bit for those few moments. What did you notice? Small little changes even. Put more attention to surroundings and the people around. Yep. So that's the mind opening up rather than this. When you're stressed, it's usually this and with gratitude, sometimes it just shifts. Yeah. JKK said, give me some head space. And I'm interpreting that as a little bit more kind of space, like a spaciousness around that. Yeah. Yeah. Others? Olivia saying, I actually thinking what I'm grateful for made me realize the things that I never actually pay attention to. Yeah. And especially if you're stressed or you're anxious, you often the last thing that you're thinking about is what you're grateful for, because the mind goes there, right? So what you're learning to do is you're working with the mind. Yeah, you're training the mind to say, hey, you know, don't forget these things. Of course, if you're someone who is truly just the ungrateful type, right, you might find it really difficult to do this, but doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where you are, it's where you start from that point, where you keep going. But if you keep doing this, it becomes second nature. It becomes natural for you to be grateful and just more open because you're inclining the mind. Remember, it's all habits here. Yeah. And then when times shake you, things that are actually not going well, you can also be able to open up a little bit more. Tamil said, felt a pinch of happiness. That's really beautiful. Like, and just a little sprinkle, a little pinch of happiness in there. It just opens up that little bit more. So as you can see, even these small things can actually shift things a little bit. Yeah, of course, like I say, you know, Buddhist practice is not something that you kind of turn to at only at the moment that you need. These are how we are living each moment, what we are training, what the habits that we put into our mind, that is what we are actually getting back. So if you're learning to incline our mind towards the good, yeah, then constantly doing that more and more, then it becomes part of the habits of the mind. So that in times of difficulty, when life shoots those arrows at us, we can then respond with flowers and lotuses rather than more arrows at ourselves. Yeah, no, I understand that it's hard, it's easier to say, easier said than done, but this is where we need to start. Really, at the heart of overcoming stress in Buddhism, really the whole part of Buddhism is about overcoming stress, distress, pain, and suffering. Right? That's what the core of the Buddha's teaching is. The Buddha says, I've taught one thing and one thing only, dukkha, which is distress and pain, and the cessation or the passing away of pain, the dukkha, cessation. I have taught one thing and one thing only, pain, distress, and the cessation of pain and distress. But we need to first start by acknowledging the pain that's actually there. It's okay. There's no need to run. Facing it as it is. Right? Ajahn Sumedho, one of the foremost Western disciples of Ajahn Chah, his meditation method, he often says, you need to be able to courageously say, this is the reality of now. So if you're sitting there, sometimes there's a pain in your leg or there's a mozzie biting you, you just know, this is itchiness. This is pain, right? Because first we need to meet with whatever is reality here. That no need to run away. We're just meeting with it, right? And then we know that the root cause of that is we're holding on to certain things or we're trying to push certain things away. There's tension in that. Relax that tension. Drop into that. Training the mind to do that time and time again. And then that will open up a bit more space for us to then do whatever is needed. But this is the whole process of training the mind over and over and over again. Yeah, and creates good, helpful habits and tendencies for us. Yeah. Other questions that you have? Feel free to type your question. Feel free to ask the question. You can unmute yourself and ask directly too. How to deal with stress and binge eating. I think that it's fairly similar. You have to first deal with the trigger of the eating part is probably like the latest part already. If you're trying to catch it at that moment, might be a little bit like far down already. It usually starts a little bit, right? Maybe unhappy or stressed or a bit upset. And then the mind says, oh, this can help. Food or whatever it is, yeah, then it goes with that. And then you deal with that, you use that a little bit, oh, it helps a little bit, yeah, but then each time you need a little bit more. It's a bit like an addiction, right? Initially, all right, every time I'm stressed, I eat a little bit of chocolate. Even if I'm stressed, I eat a little bit of chocolate. I do that too sometimes, right? But the thing is that when they study that, they find that each time if you do that, the next time you have the same amount of chocolate, the same amount of stress, the so-called happiness is reduced. So you need more chocolate to get the same level of happiness. And then the third time you come, you need even more chocolate to get the same level of relief. So that's why it becomes a pattern. And what happens is, remember we were saying early on, this is a pattern. Yeah, that is very well practiced. Initially stress, you eat a little bit, oh, deal with it that way, deal with it that way, right? And over time, it becomes a very well practiced. We become expert in dealing with it that way. Right, stress immediately, eat food, bang, or whatever it is, addiction, alcohol, this or that, yeah? Or sometimes it's control or work. It becomes a pattern that we form time and time again. It's a well-worn path, right? It becomes very good, very quick at that. So what we need to do is to actually learn to actually watch that initial direction and try to just turn it to something else, yeah? Of course, there's a whole lot more in, you know, there's whole treatments to do with binge eating, but the first fundamental part is being able to catch ourselves to see whether there are other ways of, you know, don't try to remove the stress, but at least try to see whether we can direct that into a different way first, right? Rather than it always going this way, t- turn it just that little bit towards something different, right? Instead of turning to food, try something else, playing around with it. Yeah. But look, first thing is recognizing that that's what's the case. Yeah, that is the reality of now. We all have our thing. We're all addicted to one thing or another, whether it's food, whether it's our phone, right, our screen, right, our social media, right? And some people have it more difficult, alcohol, whatever, self-harming or whatever it is. We all have something. Yeah. But it's being able to actually first recognize that this is what I have, right? This is the reality of it. Yeah, and learning to see whether I can then catch it a little bit early, learn to deal with the stresses there, and then to change the path towards something a little bit more helpful. Yeah. Hopefully that's something helpful. Are there other questions?
I'll squeeze in one last question before we end.
Go for it. Yes, Olivia.
I feel like sometimes a bit of stress can be helpful because that can motivate people. Like if you worry about something, then you would feel like you would need to make effort to make that something works. Yeah. But what if like someone deals with stress kind of differently, so like the person is not worried at all, so when like the stress comes, the person will just like, yep, it's there, but then like the person doesn't act, or like, yeah, like how to motivate someone.
Yeah, if this is a purely psychological forum, I'll talk to you about that. Stress is indeed an inverse U-curve, we call it, right? Mm. So the relationship between stress and productivity, right? This is productivity, this is stress. The more stress that you have, the more productivity that you have. But if the stress keeps increasing, the productivity starts to go down, right? That's why it's called an inverse U-curve. It's like an N shape, right? So no stress, nothing happens. A little bit of stress, okay, get moving a little bit. Right, hey, you know, you should be moving. A bit more stress, right? A bit more productivity. But then after a certain point, even more stress starts to go down. Productivity starts to go down, right? So in some ways, that is correct. From a Buddhist perspective as well, we recognize that that is the case, right? And in fact, sometimes in meditation or Buddhist teachings, we are being told, remember, death is near, right? There's uncertainty. It kind of stresses us out a little bit so that we take action and go and practice some more, correct? So there's a little bit of that. But ultimately, from a purely Buddhist perspective, is that the motivation does not need to come from fear and distress, but it can come from something deeper, which is you can be motivated by love and kindness and by compassion for others. You don't need to be waiting until you stress, then you start moving. I mean, I get that. I mean, you used to be a university student. Exam is not, it's a bit far down the track. Don't need to study for it. And then exam gets a little bit closer. Oh, productivity goes up a little bit. Oh, exam comes a little bit closer and it goes up a little bit more. And if you don't study, you're like, you're still procrastinating, and then it gets too near, and then I can't study, you can't go in anymore, right? But the thing is that that's usually how humans are, right? You're correct, 100% correct, Olivia, in that when there's a little bit more push, then there's a little bit more things happening. But that is not the only way that you can function. From a Dharma perspective is that, you know, of course, make use of that, you know, right? Making sure that you find a good level, right? Not too little, not too much, that's fine, yeah? But from a Dharma perspective is that we learn to deal with it in a way that we are substituting that with other qualities of the mind, such as love, kindness, care, compassion. And the actions that are driven from that place has a very different motivation. Yeah, that's actually pleasant by its nature. It's necessarily, naturally pleasant. Yeah, because stress can be quite unpleasant. Right? But if you're being motivated by loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, the four immeasurables, it actually feels very pleasant. Even if you're helping others in pain, there's a pleasantness around that. Yeah, and that is what the Dharma allows us to actually go a little bit beyond. Yeah. Hopefully that gives you a few things to be playing around with, Olivia.
Yep. Thank you.
So yes, I'll say that probably because of time, shall we finish off there? Hopefully this is something that's been useful. Just remembering a few things, which is each moment is we are creating habits for ourselves. My invitation is that for us to actually rely on what the Buddha has given us to learn to create good habits for ourselves so that we strengthen the mind's ability to actually live with, manage, and ultimately transcend stress, distress, suffering, and anxiety. And it's totally possible. And it does every step that you take, every investment you make, that much is a return to us. Yeah, so this is my encouragement to you. And hopefully it's something helpful for you to reflect on, for you to expand on, and for you to keep going. So thank you so much for this.